I'm Catherine Nichols, and this is Lit Century, a podcast where we talk about one book for each year of the 20th century. This week our year is 1930, and our book is Civilization and Its Discontents by Sigmund Freud. I'll be discussing it with Jessica Gross. Her nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Paris Review Daily, and other places, and she's also the author of the novel Hysteria, which is about a young woman's relationship with Freud, so you can imagine how glad I was when she agreed to come and talk to me for this episode. For a summary of the text, it's from pretty late in Freud's career, and he makes reference to a lot of his earlier ideas about developmental experiences that people have in the course of growing up, defining their later psychological states. But he puts that into a context of just the construction of civilization and the difficulty of living as an individual in society. How society asks each of us to repress some amount of our true natures to live around one another safely. All right. I hope that all makes sense. On to our conversation. So what was your original relationship with Freud's work? Like, you have written a book about a novel about a woman's relationship with Freud, but what's your relationship with Freud?
So I started seeing a therapist in my very early 20s, which I didn't know anything about the different kinds of therapy. I really, truly don't think I had heard much about psychoanalysis or really knew what it was. But it turned out that this woman who I happened to relate to as a therapist was a psychoanalyst. And I really got into it. I started seeing her more often. It became its own analysis. And as I was seeing her in my personal life, I also started reading Freud on the side, kind of trying to get an intellectual handle on the theory and, you know, like pick and choose the parts that like related to my brain in my mind. And then I, maybe it was 10 years ago. Yeah, 2010, something like that. I took a course at the New School from a professor named Alan Bass, who's a Freud scholar, and started kind of learning a little bit more in a more regimented way. And of course, did my own research for Hysteria, a novel that I wrote, which contains a version of Freud as imagined up by the narrator. So yeah, it's been a kind of like,
I love that.
On and off reading experience over the past decade or so, I would say.
So what are the ideas from this particular text, the Civilization and Discontents, that feel most resonant or interesting to you?
I think it is so, I mean, the thing that I really admire about so much of Freud's writing is the way that he not only builds upon the ideas that he lays out in future parts of the text, but like keeps inverting and twisting and adding a little wrinkle. And so this is not talking about the content so much as the fact that the style in which he unfurls his ideas almost mimics his concept of the human mind. So, you know, things aren't always what they seem. He lays something out and then sort of turns it on its head and is like, well, actually, what if we understand it this way? And, you know, that's exactly how he understands what our minds do in the ideas and feelings that they present to us. Often something contains its opposite. Something is converted into another form that we can deal with more comfortably, or into another form that persecutes us. So in terms of the kind of, you know, ideas that he's laying out, I think, you know, the text ends up building to this concept that civilization asks of us that we basically do something with our intense aggressive instincts, our death drive, that is not turning them outward against our fellow man or against our authority figures. And so the outcome of that is that instead of being outwardly aggressive, we turn our aggression against ourselves and develop these really intense super egos that, yeah, persecute us from inside our minds. And this is the way that we are able to live discontentedly in harmony with each other, that there's a price to pay for being in civilization, but there's also the gains of security. And I think that's really fascinating. It feels pretty to me.
I think the thing you said about how he kind of unrolls his thoughts and the opposite of what he's saying is often contained inside what he's saying. I think one of those examples is how he talks about people as essentially solitary in a way, that civilization is something we choose. Civilization is something that we make, that there's some different non-civilized version of people where you're more primal, you're more free. And he doesn't really have any evidence for that or any reason to believe it. He just asserts sort of like that human neutral is an 18-year-old man who has all of the skills he needs to survive. And and then it's only at the point that he wants to have sex that he has to sort of pursue other people. You know, that he sort of has this, on the one hand, this idea of the individual as the neutral state, but then the way that he talks about human development is through babies and toddlers who are obviously extremely not in their neutral state alone.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I think that that's one of those, it's one of the complexities of the text and one of the complexities of his thinking, that there's a long tradition of people thinking about human nature with the neutral state being assumed to be a competent adult individual, maybe this is me speaking as a parent, but it just seems like nonsense to me that there's any such thing as an individual human any more than there's like an individual ant. An individual ant isn't a way of understanding ant nature, and nor is an individual person a way of understanding human nature. He's not stopping there because he's incredibly interested in how people learn who they are in relation to others through childhood and through experiences, which in its own way is one of the things that I keep running into when I'm reading 20th century texts for this podcast, is I don't think that there's the same idea that traits come from experiences all the way through 19th century fiction. That there isn't necessarily this is like kind of a joke online, but like the Dalmatians killed my parents, you know, origin story, like the idea of the origin story, the idea that you would have experiences that turn into traits as you learn lessons from them, that are either, like you said, that they're either persecuting you from inside your mind or they are, you know, giving you some safety or security or whatever, or an explanation for your life or your desires or whatever it is. It's just such it's a thread that goes through so much 20th century storytelling. The idea that what storytelling is for is describing how we developed into what we are and why. And I think it's a fascinating thing that even if there are some things that I think like, well, Freud, I believe you're wrong about that, you know, like put a little X in the margins of my copy. At the same time, that idea that part of storytelling is for understanding how we came to be what we are, it's almost impossible to overstate how influential that is. And how much it doesn't seem to be how things were before, like what storytelling was perceived to be, you know, even quite recently in the same tradition.
Yeah. Well, and can you talk a little bit more about that? Like what you see it as being before?
Oh, well, like Jane Eyre would be an example of a book where in some ways there's those like destructive death drive or erotic drive are some sort of personified by external characters. And there's there's part where Jane is a child and she has these experiences and yet the book never as far as I can tell, I mean, other people could disagree with me, the book never says, and this is the experience that Jane had that made her unusually interested in her own dignity, or that she learned that love meant this from her father, or, you know, like whatever it is, it really doesn't try to make a causal relationship between her childhood experiences and her adult nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it has all the ingredients. It just doesn't bake that cake, you know?
It's so interesting. Yeah, right. And what you're saying is that is basically what psychoanalysis is all about. And so it seems to have had a profound influence on not just our understandings of ourselves, but the way we tell stories. And of course, psychoanalysis is its own form of storytelling. That's the whole, I mean, it's not the whole treatment, but it is, in my view, a big part of the treatment is, like, you know, constructing a story of your own life, or co-constructing a story of your own life with your analyst in a way that makes sense to you and allows you to have perspective on it and allows you to move beyond it. But right, it's predicated on the fact that before your life was kind of mired in your influences, and you were, just the product of your history. And now through this storytelling, you can, you know, free yourself from that entrapment, I guess.
Yeah. I was reading the Wikipedia page about civilization, its discontents. And it says, like, well, you know, of course, since it's written in 1930, like, a lot of his ideas come from, I don't even know if the words emotional response really covers it, but like the emotional slash intellectual cultural response to World War One.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a lot of forces asking people to distance themselves from the instructions of society, to not just say, like, oh, I want this, and I'm told I want it by society. Like, I want to be a warrior. This is what being a warrior means. And then it's like, no, that's not actually what being a warrior means. And not in this context of industrialized warfare. It really means this other thing. And that that you have to take a critical, distanced kind of relationship to what society's messages are.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like, again, like, once the 20th century really gets underway, the idea that you're supposed to read society's messages toward you critically, like, that everyone from every part of society, as far as I know, has some sense that there should be a distance between yourself and what you're being told you should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's necessary to free yourself, but it's necessary to even have a sense of self at all.
Yeah.
And obviously Freud's, what is it, nephew, Bernays, like, just, you know, mass advertising culture, like, is part of that need to distance yourself from what you're being told.
Yeah.
But again, like, I don't think that predates him that much. Like, it just seems like one of those ways that Freud's thinking style became everyone's thinking style.
That is so interesting. I mean, the thing that it's making me think of in this particular text, I mean, it's not a response to mass media, but there's, like, that extended portion where he takes as his starting point the dictum to love thy neighbor as thyself, which has just been, you know, in his view, taken on board without question. And he basically parses it to the level where, as you're reading the text, it becomes very hard not to see it as absurd. Like, yeah, why ever would somebody love a stranger more than they love themselves, a person who they, you know, who they need to protect in order to live? Why would they love? So anyway, and so I feel like in that long section, he's kind of modeling exactly what you're talking about, which is taking a critical approach, even to the most basic assumptions that the world has been constructed upon, in order to more fully understand the underlying mechanisms of what's going on and what this dictum is trying to usher us to do or be.
Yeah. Yeah. Another side of it, though, is the figure of the psychoanalyst, which I think this was something that I was talking about in the Christopher Pike episode, actually, which is kind of, it just that there are these, you know, teen thrillers from the 80s and 90s. And it was really striking to me how culture had changed in favor of self-identification now. And reading these books, I was thinking like, wow, they don't let the characters self-identify in any way, in ways that teenagers now, I think, assume that they would be allowed to, even encouraged to understand themselves and identify their own qualities. But I think that that sense that not only should you read your own stories critically, but that you also kind of need an editor to tell you whether you got it right or not. Like as in the psychoanalyst, that somebody else will ultimately tell you when you've achieved kind of sanity or like a healthy, or you need somebody to mediate between yourself and
yourself.
And yourself, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like in an ideal world, the patient, you know, is the one who ultimately understands that the treatment is complete. But right, there's like what grows out of the concept that our minds are total mysteries to us, which is, I think, like the most revolutionary aspect of Freudian psychology, is the necessity for an onlooker to help make sense of what it is that's going on. And yeah, I don't know. It's very true to my experience when I like am in a fight and I'm like, I truly don't know what's happening. I don't know why I'm saying the things that I'm saying. And, you know, it takes somebody with perspective and distance, and, you know, a lack of emotional investment and in the outcome, to be able to enter and make sense of the situation and what's going on. But yeah, it's a revolutionary concept that a person who you know nothing about, who's just listening to you for whatever minutes and then hours and years on end, can make more sense of your mind for you than often you can yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of relating to like the question of whether human neutral is an individual or a person among people. Mm-hmm. Where the object of analysis is an individual, but it's happening in community with the analyst. You know, the idea, sort of the central idea of this is that there's this paradox of civilization, that we create it and it destroys us. But
that we still need it, you know. Yeah. It doesn't seem to me that he's arguing against the existence of civilization so much as explaining how it could be the thing that we construct and need doesn't bring us the happiness that we think we want it to bring us.
Yeah. It's just so interesting that feeling of like just not being that happy is just like absolutely baked into the whole premise of modern life.
Yeah.
It's just confusing to pursue what the causes could be. And some of the causes, I think some of the causes he's totally right about. And then some of the other causes, I don't know, some of the other books that you can read from, you know, soon after this, like Nightwood is another one. And Nightwood is the Juna Barnes book that we already did an episode on. And I mean, she's right to be unhappy because society is really cruel and judgmental toward gay women trying to live independent, full lives and live in the arts, like all of these things. She's right to be miserable. And her misery isn't something that's that could be analyzed individually, because there isn't actually a way that she could get to a happy state while her society kind of hates her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's almost one of the the challenges, I don't even want to quite say flaws, but the challenges of thinking of happiness or unhappiness of civilization as happening to individuals, as opposed to like big tides of circumstance that could make a person be right to despair.
Mm-hmm.
And that health is actually not possible in some circumstances, like mental health, let's say, is not possible in some circumstances. And I guess that's kind of what he's saying in general, is that mental health may not be possible in the circumstances of living in society at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that. I mean, I want to see if I can find it. But there's that passage toward the end where he's basically positing that, that civilization sometimes asks of us more than we are capable of doing. So there's this passage where he's talking about the cultural superego and says it doesn't trouble itself enough about the facts of the mental constitution of human beings. It issues a command and does not ask whether it is possible for people to obey it, and assumes a man's ego is psychologically capable of anything that is required of it. And I feel like this passage starts to get at what you're talking about, which is that, you know, the price for the security and stability and protection of living in community with others, which is what he's arguing is the necessity for civilization, is that sometimes these dictums that are placed on us in response are just like so painful that we actually can't meet them.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that seems like World War I is one of those examples where it's like nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted it to be like that. Nobody wanted their role in it to be what it was. And yet no one was able to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so ominous. I mean, this book, it's so ominous how close this book comes out to the start of the next war. And it just feels so prescient what he's writing about, how strong our death drives are, our drives toward aggression, and how our aggression needs to go somewhere. And if it's not in, then it's out. And one of the ways he describes early in the book, aggression turning outward is against different groups of people. It's such a like chilling end of this book, I think, coming at the time that it does. But who can foresee with what success and with what result? And then, yeah, we know what happens next. So,
I got more stuck on the things that he was saying about people sort of turning against themselves and the feeling of anxiety or shame or guilt all the time, for essentially not, that even if you think selfish thoughts, you'll punish yourself for them because you're not, or even if you know that your interpretation of whatever's happening is not the broad society-wide one, you'll punish yourself for not conforming. But it's true that the other side of that is, what if you don't? Like, what if you actually just let your drives go free, mm-hmm. and just how massively destructive those are when people actually do that?
Yeah.
Which he doesn't really spell out. There's one part that he kind of spells out, like, how much happier are we because of medicine? Like, sure, maybe we're a bit happier, but then maybe we're actually not as much happier as we think just because all of our children are alive and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's
such an, he's like, well, yeah, we can talk on the telephone to far-flung relatives, but if ships hadn't been invented, they wouldn't have even gone there in the first place. They would just be near.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I was thinking about it alongside like Picasso or Cubism, which is another, it seems to me like a way of thinking about other people's societies. You know, like Picasso could see flea market finds of various statues and bits and pieces from other places, like, you know, cultures in Africa, and he wouldn't know anything about them. He wouldn't know anything about the culture that produced the work. It would just be kind of there. And it was the result of colonialism, and nobody around was necessarily all that curious or interested. It's just an object with a set of aesthetic properties that he was like, oh, I'll just make something up. Mm-hmm. This probably means something magic because it came from Africa. I don't really know. And like, curiosity is impossible in the framework of colonialism anyway. Like, the kind of curiosity that would get beyond the point that he's like, well, here's a statue, I'm going to invent cubism. And I think that there's a way in which this text is similar to that invention mm-hmm. of cubism, mm-hmm. which is like, it's an offshoot of both the psychological state of colonialism and just the material circumstances of colonialism, where you get a certain amount of information about how other people live, but it's impossible to make meaningful context.
Yeah.
So you just have to make up the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But you're also being empowered to do so by being told, like, well, what you have is civilization and what they have is just, like, I don't know, magic or something.
Right.
A bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the underpinning of colonialism. And I have this idea that's sort of one of the things that is, it's like the underground lake of this text mm-hmm. is the idea that he doesn't quite know how people are living in societies that are not quote unquote civilization.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where they don't have telephones, but they also don't live far apart. And he doesn't really know if they're happier or not. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really have a way of finding out.
Yeah.
So he's just making a series of guesses that are mostly about, like, there must be a different way to live than the way that he personally perceives people living all around him.
Right.
And it may have happened in the past. It may happen in the future. It may happen on a different continent, but there must be something else other than this particular quality of unhappiness.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, it certainly doesn't have the ring of a very involved anthropological study about it. There's just this, like, kind of vague primitive people. Anytime you read, like, primitive, it's like, oh God, Freud. No.
It's not great.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I think, you know, it almost, I feel like, usually when I read him in, you know, doing that kind of thing, I almost take it like he's doing a thought experiment more than saying something that's actually factually accurate. He's almost right. It's exactly what you said. He's like doing a kind of hypothetical thought experiment about what would it be like if, you know, people weren't bound together in the way that I see them bound together in, you know, whatever early 20th century Vienna. But yeah, I don't think that taking him literally in those sections is fruitful and definitely gives him too much credit, I would say. But I think, you know, I feel like the way that he, I feel like the thought, if you almost read it as a fairy tale or thought experiment, I feel like I can become incredibly engaged in the sort of intellectual work that he's doing. But right, if you read it from a colonialist context, it's, you know, you want to urge him to actually just stop and do the research that he needs to do in order to speak knowledgeably about the reality of other possibilities.
Yeah. And then also it's like, I'm not sure that I would be thrilled to read his anthropological, you know, like, if, like, I don't really want to know what Picasso actually thinks, you know, about various, like, I'd rather know what Picasso thinks about what he's actually perceiving. And mm-hmm. similarly with Freud, like, I don't think it discredits it as, you know, as you're saying, it's like the thought experiments or fairy tales or
sort of pushing on what he perceives and figuring out which parts of these things are necessary and which things are just contingent. That seems more valuable than whatever form of anthropological work he could have actually done.
Yeah.
And I think it's like that from where these people were in Europe, they are getting all of this new information, but they really aren't in a position to actually perceive it sort of in context. They can only perceive it in their own context.
Yeah, right.
Like a text that would come from a lot of, like a big emotional need from his side.
Mm.
Like a feeling of, I guess, of coming to a point in his own life where he maybe doesn't feel that it's as possible to escape himself as want. I don't know, like if you're young and you think like, oh, you can just change your circumstances and things will get better. And then at some point you realize you can't really escape yourself. Mm-hmm. It feels like a text of a person who's discovered he can't escape himself.
It's like, why am I so unhappy? Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I doubt that it's possible to reach adulthood in any human context without feeling that you're somewhat at war with yourself.
Mm.
Like that the needs of the group versus the needs of the individual are always going to be tangled up inside your head.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that way. I'm sad to say.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think that idea, like, are these things unchangeable or are they changeable? Like you were saying before that that part of the point of the psychoanalysis is that they are somewhat changeable. You can kind of understand what you're doing and why.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in that way, it's like a very interesting book to try to square with his mission as a psychoanalyst, which is fundamentally to like free people, because there's like something very pessimistic, obviously, about this text. It's like, well, okay, I'll try to help you understand yourself so you can be free of the strictures that, you know, the shape of your upbringing has placed on your psyche. And yet you can only be but so happy because you have to live in community with other people. And this great sacrifice that I've just laid out is thus required. So yeah, it's a, it doesn't leave us in a particularly hopeful or optimistic place. The end of this text, I would say.
You just said before, how much it really does feel like not just a post-World War I, but an immediately pre-World War II text.
Yeah. And in fact, that last line that I read, I believe the footnote in my version says that it was added. The final sentence was added in 1931 when the menace of Hitler was already beginning to be apparent. So this is like at the kind of germination of the war and the Holocaust that he was writing this and even amending it a little bit more to reflect the ominousness of what was going on at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely like when you think about what is wrapped up in the word discontents, it's a lot of behavior that I think we try to distance from the word civilization.
Mm.
Like we don't want to think of civilization as including the Holocaust. We want it to be something that's an aberration or like a mistake that we could understand and not do, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to part of the nature of being in a civilization at all, that the scale of action could be unstoppable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the nature of being in a civilization and also the nature of being a person. I do think that his conviction that aggression is such a big part of our psyches is really valuable because yeah, what do we get from denying that? Only more tragedy. I mean, it's only by acknowledging this and figuring out how to work with destructive impulses in ourselves and in our culture more broadly that we can try to counteract them. It's hard to counteract something you're denying exists.
It's true. And I think that the reframing of the urge as belonging to the person who has the urge rather than the thing that the other person deserves. I think that that's the way that it would be framed before. Mm-hmm. It's just that those people need to be squashed and I think that this is also something that happens in a libidinous urge. Does the desire arise from the attractive person or does it arise from the person looking mm-hmm. the attractive person? And I think that was probably has never been less stable than in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The question of whether the urge arises in the person who feels the urge or it arises from the person who's in whatever way the person who will be the recipient of the action.
That's such an interesting framing. Yeah.
Because I don't think that we settled it. I don't think that we're at ease about that question. But I think that it's sort of in play that maybe you don't cause desire by wearing a short skirt. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, I think that in earlier texts in this tradition, I think it seems much more settled that the person who gets destroyed caused it by whatever. Sorry.
Such a successful.
Really badly.
What? No, this is
not at all. I'm like thinking more thoughts that I can say.
I feel like reading Freud inspires that feeling in me. I just, it's like, oh, I understand it as I'm reading it. And then it makes my mind go in all these directions. And it feels so exciting. And then after it, I'm like, wait, what just happened?
Yes.
Do I articulate what happened? How do I even summarize what I just read and understood as I was reading it? Yeah.
I have so many notes and then I'm looking at them and thinking the same thing you said originally, which is like, no, it's not quite that. It's also the opposite of that.
Yeah. And it's so, I don't know. I mean, it's funny because throughout this entire text, I mean, you know, Freud had his grandiosity, of course, but in this particular text and in others, he's so, he keeps saying over and over, I don't know if this struck you too, but he keeps saying over and over, I know I'm not saying anything original. This is all very banal. I'm just repeating things everyone already knows. And then at the same time, I feel like my mind being blown and being stretched in all these different directions. And I like read to try to keep up with the next little turn or move that he's mm-hmm. doing and the way that he's building on what he just said or inverting it. And, and he's like, I know, you know all this already. And I'm like, no, I do not. So just keep going.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, there was just something, I mean, you touched on it earlier, so I don't know if it's worth bringing back at this point, but I think his idea is very interesting that the superego sees more, that, you know, the superego internal inside our minds sees more than the external authority figure does.
Yeah.
Which is to say that, you know, if you do something bad, if your only worry is not being punished by an external authority figure, it's only if you do something bad that it's a problem, because then you can be caught. But when this authority figure is taken inside of you as your punitive superego, as you were saying before, the thought itself, the desire to do something bad, you know, quote bad, immoral, is a punishable offense because the superego can see it. It can't just see what you do. It can see what you think. And that's, I don't know. It's a very, yeah, it seems so right to me.
It does seem right. And it also seems like an obvious source of that desire to offload the blame onto the person that you did the bad thing to, opposed to own the urge yourself.
Yeah. Well, it's so understandable why it's tempting to offload the blame onto that person, because then the cycle is complete. They're like truly holding this aggression for you. You don't have to hold it anymore. yourself. Exactly. If it's their fault, they provoked it and they basically did it to themselves. So you can just kind of like, you know, barf the aggression onto them and then back away and feel freed, as opposed to, right, if it's coming from you, then you still have to grapple with and hold it yourself, yeah. Which is very uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that also, I think it's part of the psychoanalytic relationship between the two people, mm-hmm. where it makes sense that it wouldn't be the same as just doing the same thinking inside yourself, because there wouldn't be somebody there to witness, like, are you actually just fully assigning the blame for your own urges onto other people? You know, like saying it out loud or saying it to another person, it seems like it actually changes the nature of what you're doing.
Totally. Which is also what makes it so remarkable to me that basically psychoanalysis originated by Freud analyzing himself. Like, he actually did just do it to himself. I'm like, I don't know how you did that at first.
Well, so one last thing that we haven't talked about yet is his idea of the oceanic feeling, which is, just for listeners who maybe didn't just read this, the oceanic feeling is a feeling of sort of limitlessness or like dissolution of the self into something larger, which he says is sort of like the basic urge that underlies religion, the desire to kind of like be one with God. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's sort of based in the feeling of the baby in the arms of the parents, where the baby doesn't feel that there's a separation between themselves and their parent. And the satisfaction of need and the feeling of a need are unified in his idea of this baby. But he also says that he doesn't feel it himself. And it makes me wonder if his experience of self is somehow a little unusual, because he really wants a lot of archetypes. He doesn't want the answer to be fundamentally different for different people. Mm-hmm. But I think in our era now, in the 21st century, especially just with the idea of neurodiversity as sort of a human neutral and not madness, but, you know, the people ought to be essentially different in various ways. I just wonder if there's something, you know, I really am not trying to diagnose him, by the way, with anything. I'm more like, I think that it ought to be true that there are many ways for people to experience sense of self.
Yeah.
I just wonder if Freud had one that was like farther off center.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've read, there's this, psychoanalyst and scholar, Joel Whitebook, who wrote a biography of Freud, which I read as I was writing my book. And he basically writes about how Freud had a very difficult childhood himself in a lot of ways. He had, I want to say, a brother who died. His mom, in response, was very depressed, possibly went away to like a sanatorium for part of his young life. And in Whitebook's estimation, Freud developed a very kind of like rigid, phallocentric personality and a defensive view of his relationship with his mother, where he basically idealized her because he wasn't equipped to process on his own the kind of disappointments and even traumas of their relationship. And so, yeah, I think, you know, in Whitebook's estimation, this limited kind of self, where he grew up really fast and was just like, I'm a man, also paved the way for him to create the works of genius that he did. But there's like parts missing, you know, missing in his analysis of the relationship between not just fathers and their children, but mothers and their children, his like understanding of women, and, you know, who knows kind of what else was the price of this, his own like childhood challenges that he didn't necessarily fully analyze in their entirety.
Yeah, but even the just even asking the question of like, why am I like this? Mm-hmm. Did I have an experience that made me like this?
Yeah.
But even that is so groundbreaking, as opposed to just thinking I should not be like this.
Yeah.
Which like just starting with why, as opposed to should I, you know, is this good? Is it bad?
Yeah.
It's like you said, it's like, it's a work of genius. Even though it also, sometimes I was definitely putting little X's and like, no, Freud, no, you know.
Yeah.
But I also think that saying like, oh, well, Freud was wrong about blah, 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 is also kind of a cliche in itself.
It's like, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It feels to me like it's sort of, not that it wastes time, but it's like, yes, of course he was wrong about certain things he was writing 100 or more years ago. There have been theory, he revised some of his own theories. There have been analysts who came after him. It's an evolving discipline, and like every discipline is like this. And I don't know, it just, to me, the stigmatization of Freud is so severe sometimes that I sort of, in a psychoanalytic way, wonder what underlies it and what discomforts are being provoked in people that, you know, that this reaction comes about where they have to like throw away the entire discipline of psychoanalysis because not 100% of the beliefs or dictums that Freud put forth continue to hold water 100 yeah. years later. Okay. Like it is, yeah, it's his writings are imperfect. His beliefs are imperfect, but there's a lot that I think we get a lot out of that we didn't have before he came along.
I agree. I think that reading this also as like a process document, kind of like a, you know, a Socratic dialogue with these ideas, I hadn't realized how interesting I would find his style. I think I read this like maybe when I was in high school and then just coming back to it as an adult and having more context for it. It's just interesting that he sort of grammatically makes claims, but in the context of his writing, it's more like he's in dialogue with claims.
Yeah, that's so well put. I mean, I find him like a relentlessly curious writer. And yeah, I mean, it's like something in, you know, I've taught nonfiction and fiction writing in college. And I feel like the thing that is really hard, but that we talk about with basically everything impressive that we read is the way that the writer is like, allowing the reader into a journey of discovery and isn't just stating something they know, but allowing the reader to explore with them and maybe writing into a space of unknowing as opposed to just like figuring it all out beforehand. And I feel like Freud is an amazing model of that. Like he genuinely seems in almost everything I've read that he writes to be like posing a question to himself and then just like pushing it absolutely as far as it will go. And again, yeah, sometimes it involves these thought experiments that in the light of 2021 can read as a bit unseemly, but as intellectual labor, I find it incredibly impressive. Just like how it's like, he's like taking an object and just like holding it to the light in every possible angle until he feels like he's like fully understood it to the best of his capacity. And I think that's cool.
All right, that's it for our episode on Freud. Thank you to Jessica for joining me and to Adam Barra for our music, and to all the people at Literary Hub for hosting us. We love to hear from listeners, so please rate and review us at Apple Podcasts or tweet us at LitCenturyPod on Twitter or write to us at LitCenturyPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks very much, and goodbye till next week.